Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, distinguished audience, and welcome to the ABC Health Corporate Alliance on Malaria in Africa podcast. My name is Dr. Maurice Atoki, and I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the African Business Coalition for Health, ABC Health. And it is my honor to serve you as your moderator during this important conversation. We are thrilled to have all of you join us as we delve into one of the most pressing public health challenges facing our continent, malaria elimination, with no other person than a very, very notable person in the industry who's done a lot of work and who I've been acquainted with for a couple of years. Now, just a little bit about malaria. Malaria remains a significant threat to health and development in Africa, affecting millions of people and businesses every year. Despite progress that we've made in recent times with increased access to prevention methods and treatment, we still face numerous hurdles in our quest to eliminate this disease. The burden of malaria disproportionately impacts vulnerable populations, particularly children and pregnant women. And it continues still to hinder economic growth and development in many regions. As we continue to discuss the devastating impact of malaria on the continent, I am delighted to highlight a significant shift in leadership, which strengthens our collective efforts. On September 16, 2023, African Business Coalition for Health transitioned into the role of Secretariat for CAMA. I like to call us CAMA Office, taking over from the Global Business Coalition for Health, GBC Health. Now, this transition remains a turning point and on our part, quite really important in Africa's fight against malaria. It's a bold move towards African-led initiatives in addressing the continent's health challenges. Now, following the successful transition of the Alliance to ABC Health on November 20, 2024, CAMA hosted a pivotal webinar titled Reimagining Vector Control Strategies for Malaria Elimination in Africa. Today, we are excited to continue this conversation from the webinar to explore innovative strategies and integrated approaches that can help us as a continent and as people to overcome all of these challenges. We will discuss the importance of collaboration among government, NGOs, the private sector, and local communities in creating sustainable solutions for malaria control and elimination. We have an experienced expert joining us today as guest. Peter is very, you will just really want to hear what Peter has to say again and again and again. I mean, I did the first time I met him, and I did again, after the podcast. So did the team from CAMA and also ABC Health. Peter today will share with us insight and experiences that he has in this combat against malaria. He will also discuss the latest advancement in research, the role of technology, and the importance of private sector engagement, as well as collaborations in achieving our goal in eliminating malaria. Peter is going to also tell us a bit about what he's up to, some of the work and research that he's doing, and what his expectations are in the market, especially on the African continent. So as we embark on this important conversation, I'd like to encourage all of you, our listeners, to reflect on the role each one of us play in this fight, whether you are a healthcare professional, a policymaker, a private sector actor, or you're just a layperson. Your involvement is crucial in making a difference. Without much ado, let's dive into our discussion. Please join me in welcoming our guest, Dr. Peter Billingsley. He's the founder of the Vital Narrative. Now, a bit about Peter. Peter has over 35 years' experience as a global health executive. He's a seasoned expert in vaccinology, malaria transmission, and vector biology. Peter's contributions have significantly advanced tropical disease and public health, reflected in over 140 peer-reviewed publications and millions of dollars secured for laboratory research, clinical studies, and capacity building projects. Peter's career spans key positions in the private sector, where he was instrumental in driving malaria vaccine research and development and academia, where he focused on medical and veterinary entomology and malaria transmission. His wealth of experience plus on-the-ground work across the continent of Africa and organizational leadership allows him to offer insights and guidance from a place of deep expertise and practical understanding that we all should expect to learn from today. Peter has served as Vice President of International Projects and Strategy at Scenaria Inc. and as Head of Zoology at the University of Aberdeen in Scotland, following a prestigious Royal Society University Fellowship held at Imperial College London. Peter holds a PhD from Queen's University, Kingston, Canada, and a BSc from Leeds University, United Kingdom. Now, to kick off our discussion, it's essential that we understand the scale of the malaria problem in Africa. Malaria is not only a health issue, it is a multifaceted challenge. I call it an ancient issue that affects millions of lives. It disrupts communities, it kills, and hampers economic development across the continent. According to the World Health Organization, Africa bears the highest burden of the disease, accounting for approximately 94% of global malaria cases and deaths. Now, this staggering statistics highlights the urgency of our conversation today. We noted Peter in his enthusiasm and passion when we were at the webinar we did just a couple of weeks ago. Now, to help us grasp the full extent of this crisis, we'd like our audience to listen as Peter provides an overview of the current malaria situation in Africa. What are the key statistics that illustrate the impact of malaria on public health, and how does this burden vary across different regions and population? In short, Peter, what is the scale of the problem that we're dealing with? Over to you, Peter.
Well, thank you for such a wonderful introduction, Marius. The scale of malaria just is horrifying. We have about nearly 600,000 people dying each year from malaria. 600,000 people, and over 260 million people infected with the parasite. As you said in your fantastic introduction, most of the disease occurs in Africa. Most of those deaths occur in Africa. Most of those deaths occur in children under the age of five. And the effects on pregnant women are very, very sad and profound, with the loss of babies, with underweight children, with reduced cognitive development as they move into infancy. So all of these things truly affect Africa more than anywhere else, very, very profoundly. And there is almost nowhere in Africa without this horrible issue. You can move from the Sahel, where it's seasonal, down to Central Africa, where there's always malaria present. But there's nobody unaffected in the whole continent, in my opinion. And of course, Nigeria has the biggest problem of all. It's one of the countries in Africa with the highest malaria burden. And it really has not changed that much over the last few years. And in fact, I would say that all these statistics from the World Health Organization show that malaria is once again on the increase, which is a wake-up call to all of us.
Right. Thank you so much for providing that level of insight to help us appreciate the scale. And I hear you say over 600,000 people have malaria on an annual basis in Africa.
Nearly 600,000 people die each year from malaria. That's the latest
Oh,
WHO.
wow.
It's 260
Wow.
million plus that have the disease.
Oh, wow. That's a huge number.
It is.
And then most of these people are children below the age of five on the continent and also pregnant women.
Yes.
And my beloved country, Nigeria, has one of the highest malaria burdens on the continent.
That's
Anyway, where
correct.
they're also the highest population. So
Exactly.
this is
You know,
such
I
a
love the
sad.
fact that in your introduction you use the word urgency. It seems to me that we saw a tremendously positive and urgent response to COVID, but because malaria has been with us so long, that sense of urgency is lost for most people.
Shameful. And I hear you. Despite the havoc and the the mortality rate that malaria poses. I think we just need, you know, more visibility and more conversations and advocacy on malaria as a disease, so people really understand the scale and the comparison also to COVID. Okay, thank you once again, Peter, for that insight that you've shared. So we will now continue in the conversation, crucially understanding disease itself, and what causes the disease and the factors contributing to its transmission. So that goes my next question, Peter. What are the primary causes of malaria, and how do environmental, social, and economic factors influence its transmission in different regions of Africa? What role do we as humans in our behavior and practices play in the spread of this ancient disease? Over to you, Peter.
A lot of questions there. So malaria, unlike COVID, is a parasite. It's a very complex organism. There are five species of malaria that affect people, and the most prevalent and most important is called Plasmodium falciparum. This is the disease, the organism that causes most of the deaths in the world and most of the deaths in Africa. Most people will know that malaria is transmitted by mosquitoes, and it really is important that we understand how those mosquitoes interact with people. And that is a very fluid thing. So what do I mean by that? If we look at how we have controlled mosquitoes in the past, it's been by spraying, and that evolved into spraying inside houses. So that was called indoor residual spraying to kill the mosquitoes when they land on the walls of a house. We've used bed nets to prevent mosquitoes feeding on people when they're asleep. And the mosquitoes in response have adapted to feeding outside instead of indoors. So now the issue that we face as a community is to change or extend the way that we control those mosquitoes so that when people are outside, they have some sort of level of control. So that's the mosquito side of it. And then, of course, with the drugs, pretty much every drug that is available for killing malaria parasites has shown to be susceptible to resistance. So every drug that we have, there is a malaria parasite somewhere that is resistant to it. Now, that is a profoundly problematical issue, because imagine it, you know, you've got a child in a hospital somewhere and the drugs now don't work very well. You've got people who are really, really sick and the drugs don't work so well. All of these drugs now are being very, very carefully managed. They're being used in combination so that an individual receives two different drugs at the same time to help cure malaria parasite and not to have the parasite only being targeted by a single drug to which it may be fully or partially resistant. So that is a massive, massive problem. And the drug pipeline for getting new drugs onto the market is notoriously slow. So that's an important factor. Another essential part of malaria control and keeping people safe is the screening and testing and treatment. This, for many, many years, this was done by what's called a thick blood smear, where a technician would take a small blood sample, place it onto a microscope slide, and they would look for parasites in that blood sample. Now, that's a very sensitive way of finding parasites if it's done well, but it's slow, it's subject to variability, and consequently, for many years, there was a push to bring out what are called RDTs, rapid diagnosis tests, and they work extremely well. They can be variably sensitive, but of course, malaria being malaria, it has evolved to evade that test. So malaria parasites have developed a change in their biology so that they don't express the antigens that the rapid diagnostic test detects. So you could declare somebody free of malaria parasites, but those parasites are still there in the blood. What I'm trying to show you here is just how plastic and adaptable both the mosquito and the malaria parasites are. And that's really why we just can't sit still and hope that what we do now is enough. In that regard, what what has come out over the last few years is two new malaria vaccines, one from called RTSS, the other one R21, from GlaxoSmithKline and Oxford University, respectively. And these vaccines are good at reducing disease and hospitalizations in children, but they don't affect the parasites in the blood. They just prevent disease. And if you don't affect the parasites in the blood, you can't reduce transmission. So what these vaccines are going to do is change the status quo, but they're not going to help us eliminate malaria. So if you put all that together, I think that sort of summarizes where we are with the understanding the biology of the parasite and what people have been trying to do about it in recent years at a very high level.
Absolutely. At a very high level, just really reflecting on that, what are the primary causes of malaria? I hear you talk about parasites transmitting the disease by mosquitoes. Of course, the Anopheles mosquito, very popular, but very different from those that transmit the dengue, for example, mm-hmm. and some others, you know, maybe not in context here. Five species of malaria, four of them on the continent of Africa, one species responsible for most of the deaths. So again, thank you so much for sharing those insights. Now we're going to examine the efforts currently underway to combat the disease. Over the years, significant strides and resources have been plucked and have been made in malaria prevention and treatment, including the distribution of insecticide-treated bed nets, indoor residual spraying, larval source management, diagnostics, and case management, and the rollout of malaria vaccines. Despite all of these efforts, and Peter, you will, you know, just reflect on this with me, malaria continues to pose a severe threat to public health, and in Africa particularly. I understand it used to be the same case in some parts of Asia, but it looks like they've been able to make some progress more than Africa. And this raises an important question. What are the key initiatives and strategies currently being implemented to fight malaria in Africa? And why aren't these efforts enough to eliminate the disease? What are the barriers and what challenges really are we talking about that is hindering our progress? Over to you, Peter.
So you've already mentioned some of those very important control measures. Bed nets have been tremendous, absolutely tremendous at bringing down the malaria case rates. So although I said there was 600,000 people die each year, you know, many years ago, that was in the millions. So bed nets and drug treatments have saved many, many, many lives. And we shouldn't underestimate just how important they remain as part of the control toolbox. But the mosquitoes become resistant to the insecticides that are used to impregnate the bed nets. And so that they then slowly become a physical barrier rather than a physical chemical barrier. Just the same, the mosquitoes have developed resistance to the insecticides that are used to spray indoors for the indoor residual spraying. And so consequently, they will survive landing on the wall, or they will go elsewhere. They'll have what's termed behavioral resistance and either go somewhere else, or as I said earlier, they'll feed outdoors where the insecticide has not been sprayed. And there's the issues of drug resistance. All of these are multiplied in Africa because of the intensity of transmission. When you start with control in Africa, you're starting with a very, very, very intense transmission, a very high bar. So if you think about it in just simple terms, if you've got 100 infectious mosquito bites a year in Africa versus 2 a year in Asia, and you reduce that by 90%, you're below 1 in Asia and you're still at 10 a year in Africa. So you're still getting that transmission rate that is sufficient to make sure that people are infected constantly. There is also the issue in Africa that there are some mosquito species that are very, very, very attuned to human behaviors. They'll feed almost exclusively on people, and consequently those mosquitoes will be the most important for the transmission in the field. So that is the core of why Africa has not become malaria free. It's just there was so much transmission that you have to start with reduction before you can even contemplate elimination. And Africa has reduced the burden significantly. Then there comes the point where you have this toolbox that we just discussed. And you can use the tools in different ways. So, for example, you can use drugs to cure people when they come to a hospital or a clinic, but you can also use drugs to do a mass administration. And if that's done in a seasonal way, as has been shown in Mali, for example, you can actually reduce the burden of malaria during the wet season because you caught the parasites before there's that wet season implementation. So it's not just having the tools, it's how you use them and how you might use them better. All those things are being investigated. But for sure, Maurice, there's not enough tools in the toolbox yet. There are still things that will eliminate infection rather than just reduce prevalence.
Oh, wow. So talking about the toolbox and some of the solutions that have actually already been deployed, let's talk a bit about vaccines. Where are we in reality on the vaccine against malaria? And I know you're doing some work around that. How would you rate the progress and the interventions by this, in quotes, vaccine for malaria? Over to you, Peter.
So there have been two malaria vaccines rolled out over the last years. They are both aimed at a single protein that is on the surface of the stage of malaria that comes from the mosquito to the human. So they attempt to reduce or even prevent the sporozoite, as it's called, getting from the mosquito to the liver of the human, where it will reside for a short time. These vaccines do not seem to affect the degree or the intensity of infection in the blood of the people who receive them.
Wow.
But they do reduce disease. So if a child has received one of these two vaccines, they have a good chance of not being so sick, of not dying, and of not ending up in hospital. So those are really, really good things, right? They're really good. So I think the way to think about these two vaccines is that they are the first level of vaccines, if you like. They are the best we can do at this point in time. And what we need to do now is have the next version, right? The next generation of malaria vaccines. And there are many people working on these. If you think about the life cycle of malaria, there's a whole set of stages of malaria that occur in the blood. And people are working to produce vaccines that target those blood stages. There are stages of malaria that occur in the mosquito. And believe it or not, people are working on vaccines that will have antibodies in the human blood, and those antibodies are passed into the mosquito, aimed to prevent the infection from humans to mosquitoes, rendering the mosquito just a pest rather than a disease-carrying organism. And then there are the vaccines that I worked on recently and for 17 plus years, which are designed to kill the parasites when they are in the liver before the human gets sick. And those whole parasite vaccines or whole sporozoite vaccines were produced by the company I work for, Sunaria. And those vaccines kill the parasite before it causes illness. And when they're working at their optimum, they prevent infection completely of the blood stages. So there is a whole portfolio of research in many, many different countries looking at the next generations of malaria vaccines. To my mind, you have to stop infection. I don't see anything working to prevent or eliminate malaria on the continent unless you eventually stop infection in some way, whether it's long-term drugs, whether it's a vaccine, whether it's a way of completely stopping a mosquito feeding on people. If you do not stop infection, you do not eliminate. It's as simple as that in my mind. Well, the World Health Organization have put a malaria vaccine to prevent infection as their top priority for the next generation of malaria vaccines.
Oh, wow. Interesting. We need to stop the infection. I do Yes. really hope that we get there, actually, and that we have our research and development advanced enough to understand that imperative. Mm-hmm. As we continue the discussion on malaria elimination in Africa, one of the critical aspects, Peter, that we must address is the efficient use of resources. With limited funding, you did talk about funding a little, and competing health priorities, I mean, COVID came down the line. Nobody expected, practically nobody saw it coming. It becomes more and more essential to maximize the impact of every dollar spent and every intervention implemented. While we have made progress, like you also alluded to, in malaria control, talking about the vaccine and what it stands to achieve, the question remains, how can we use our current resources more efficiently and differently to enhance malaria elimination efforts? And what are the innovative approaches that can be adopted to ensure that we are getting the most out of our investments in prevention, in treatment, and as you said, in, you know, just really stopping the infection? Over to you, Peter.
Thank you. The issue of funding, of course, is right at the heart of all of this, because if there was sufficient funding, the coverage for all of the control measures that we've discussed so far, Maurice, would be there and be much more widely used. But the funding isn't there, and it's important then to use what we have wisely. So if I think about the one project I've been involved with, which is called the Bioko Island Malaria Elimination Program, they have tried very much an IRS, indoor residual spraying-centric approach. And over the years, they reduced malaria by up to 17%, which from a very high bar, the very high numbers of parasites in the population, that was a tremendous success. But what they found is recently that they can obtain the same effect, meaning a significant reduction in malaria, with less coverage. And that is by targeting where they use the insecticides, maybe thinking that there's in a denser population that the effect of spraying in one house actually has an effect in that on the houses around it too. And then to push out, integrating that with larval source management. So you look for the places where the mosquito numbers are highest, find out where those puddles and pools are that the mosquitoes are breeding in, and control those alongside the IRS program. And then to decentralize it, to push that control and surveillance out to a district level. And what that does is give you a shorter response time. And if the resources are there already at the district, you reduce the issues in your supply chain as well. So that is what the Bioko Island Malaria Elimination Program has done. There's also organizations like the IVCC, the International Vector Control Consortium, and they are looking at new technologies which actually reduce the amount of insecticide needed. I mean, what they're doing there is pretty cool. They are monitoring what goes on right at the tip of a spray so that they know exactly how much insecticide is being sprayed. They've changed the way that the nozzle works, so it's laser assisted, and they can watch everything being done through an app so that they've got a really very accurate means of assessing coverage. And again, their focus now, or part of their focus, is to push out this control into smaller centers so that there is a much more localized way of controlling that isn't so top heavy that it becomes burdensome administratively. I've mentioned a couple of times already that the mosquitoes have become adapted to feeding outdoors in response to other control measures. And there's quite a significant amount of effort now on looking at sort of a cloud of insecticide repellency so that mosquitoes are kept away from the household, maybe from a few meters around the household, so that people can sit around at night while the mosquitoes would otherwise be feeding and be a lot more safe. These are looking quite promising. They are not deployed yet, but they essentially are the next generation of prevention and control. As you know, almost all traditional African houses have open eaves. So between the roof and the wall of the house, for ventilation purposes, there is a gap, and that's very much the preferred way for mosquitoes to enter the house. And there are a number of ways now to control mosquitoes at that point. So there are traps that can be used for the mosquitoes trying to get in through the trap instead of through the eaves, and the mosquitoes are killed there. And the joy of that approach is that it uses very, very little insecticide. You're targeting the mosquitoes well. You can put ribbons that are insecticide pregnated around the eaves, and that also greatly reduces the number of mosquitoes coming into the house. And there's also a lot of work has been done on what are called toxic sugar baited traps. Now, these consider the behavior of mosquitoes away from the human host. Mosquitoes don't just feed on blood. They need sugar and water as well. So they will go and feed on nectar from flowers. And so the idea here was that you would attract the mosquitoes to something that they think is a flower, but it has an insecticide in there. And these only seem to work when there are not alternative sources of sugar around. So at the moment, they don't look too promising, but that doesn't mean they will not work. There are a lot of good people doing good work on these. There's also the possibility to repurpose drugs that have been developed for other reasons. One of those is ivermectin, which was developed as an agent for worms, so for reducing tapeworm and nematodes in people and in animals. It has a very strong veterinary use. And ivermectin also can kill mosquitoes. The idea here is that you give people ivermectin and you give the animals in the same space ivermectin. And so you reduce the survival of the mosquitoes feeding on those people and those animals. The issue here is repeated dosage, but I think it's also good to consider that you don't always just want to focus on one thing. So for ivermectin, it's possible that it's real value will come in reducing people's burdens of bed bugs and scabies and worms at the same time as having some effect on malaria. So that is, if you like, an added value approach that isn't discussed often enough for me. It's also important to remember that there's no one size fits all here. If we think about a few examples, Africa was controlling mosquitoes native to the continent for many years, and then recently it has an invasive species, a new mosquito for Africa called Anopheles stevensi, which has come from Asia. And this changes the picture completely because Anopheles stevensi is a very urban mosquito. It'll breed in dirty water, which the African mosquitoes don't do so easily. And it represents a tremendous threat to the continent. So all of a sudden, we're not just looking at the changes in the behaviors of the mosquitoes we control and the changes in drug resistance. Now we've got a new mosquito which doesn't behave the same way as the mosquitoes we know so well in Africa. And it is a tremendous vector. One size doesn't fit all if you're comparing urban and rural malaria. One size doesn't all fit all if we compare just in one country. So in Equatorial Guinea, for example, control program there has reduced the diversity of mosquito species down to just one vector on the island of Bioko, but on the mainland of Equatorial Guinea, all of the traditional vectors will be in place. I think you mentioned in your question there, partnerships, Maurice, and they are so important to what we do and to for success. If I look at the acknowledgement slide that Scenaria has always put up at the end of a presentation, there's 30 or 40 partners working with just one company in the world to make a success of those sporozoite vaccines. And every researcher in the malaria space does the same thing. So it's a big network of people all working towards the same end. But we also need partnerships that bring money to the table, because it's no good having these wonderful brains if you don't fund their innovations. And so that, to me, there's the traditional partnerships of funding like the Gates Foundation, the Wellcome Trust in the UK, many of the NIH, and so many, many others. But I think the diversity of partnerships on the funding side, there's a lot of scope for improvement there. I think that's a good place to stop. I think we've talked about partnerships. We've talked about better use of resources. I think in all of that, we think about integrating those resources. So we don't just say we're going to use bed nets. We don't say we're just going to use drugs. You have to pull them all together into one coherent program. And it's also got to be a very responsive and fluid program so that you can be ready for things like drug resistance emerging in a new place or an awfully Stephen size showing up where it wasn't before. I think that's
absolutely
a long answer to your questions.
No, long at all. I mean, I do also realize how fragmented that question is, talking about efficient use of resources. I mean, you delve into partnerships. I mean, it's also insightful to know that there are African mosquitoes now. I mean, so what it just means is for Africa to speed up its game and, you know, wear its innovative heart really much more seriously. And talking about innovation, it's just really critical to highlight the role that innovation plays in this fight against malaria, especially on the African continent. We talk about new technologies, to novel approaches, you know, to centric African-related ones. I mean, your example in New Guinea, did you say two different areas that called for two different elimination methods? Depending on, you know, either the prevalence or the size of the transmitter and so on and so forth. And so with that in mind, I'd like to pose this other question. What innovative solutions or technologies are currently being developed? And I hear some of those answers in your previous answer to efficient utilization of resources. But talking about innovations and peculiarities and how they align to the specificity of some of these particular malaria diseases on an African level, how are these innovations being deployed and how are they impacting on diagnosis, on treatment?
I think one useful way to look at this is that every control that we have for malaria is an innovation of some sort. If I go back to when I was a very green young entomologist, sent to Tanzania by the Swiss Tropical Institute, as it was then. And we deployed bed nets. We were looking at research to deploy insecticide-treated bed nets. And they were new and they were exciting and they were precious to all of us. And that innovation is now the standard of control. And it takes a long time to go from the point of innovation to deployment and utility and effectiveness. So it's always worth bearing that in mind, is that innovation is an investment. And it doesn't always work, but it can be the most important part of investment as we kick things off. So with that in mind, we have to recognize that whatever solutions we have now will not last forever. We know that. I mean, this is what we've talked about the last few minutes, Maurice. Resistance to insecticide, resistance to drugs, resistance even to the diagnostic approach of RDTs. So innovation has to be constant. It really has to be like a switch that is constantly on. You have to foster that innovation all the time. I can give you two examples of innovation that I know pretty well, and then maybe we can talk about where there's some absence of innovation. So the one, of course, I'm going to wave a flag for Cineria, the company I used to work for. Their vaccines are built on innovation. They were always from the start targeted at preventing infection, which is completely different from any other vaccines that are being pushed out. And the reason for that was manifold, but if you target infection, you have the potential for reducing the overall burden of malaria and then even elimination. But even with a massively wonderful data set that Cineria has, where prevention of infection has been shown time and time again, the company has funding issues, is not able to secure the funding to take it to the next level of putting that innovation into a more practical context so that those vaccines can be tested at a larger scale. So that's a really important element of innovation, is not only just securing the funding to start kick off the innovative thoughts, but then to have the grit and the consistency to maintain that. And if anybody has an interest in helping Cineria, please get in touch, I think. The other interesting one that I was listening to a podcast of theirs recently, is a company in Oxford called Oxutech. And Oxutech have taken the approach of genetically changing mosquitoes so that the offspring are not fecund. So eventually what happens is that as these genetically modified mosquitoes are released, the population of mosquitoes declines and the transmission rate gradually goes down and down and down. Now, this is being done pretty successfully for dengue, and it will eventually happen with the malaria mosquitoes. They're just more difficult to work with. But the advantage is here, you're not putting in insecticides into the environment, so you don't have off-target effects. These mosquitoes spread themselves, so the level of coverage that you need for this approach is less than with insecticides, for example. And so you can have a low level to sustained effort to have a major impact. And I'm really looking forward to seeing the Oxutech mosquitoes really have a profound effect in the malaria space. So from there, I think those are two very excellent examples of innovation for malaria control. I think what I'd like to move on to is where we don't get innovation.
Please go ahead.
Yeah, okay. So innovation comes in many, many different forms. And it's that early part of the pipeline that is very, very difficult sometimes to kick things off. So somebody, very often it's a young research scientist, has some great ideas, and they have to fight to get a grant. They have to work very hard to get anything that someone would consider a potential product rather than just a good idea. So that early innovation is very important to foster. And at the moment, I feel that there are so many, many good ideas on the continent of Africa, but the infrastructure to get them from idea to early stage product to development seems to be fragile or absent, in my opinion. So what I see is that some of the investors, some of the people who are really working and doing a fantastic job at making sure there's malaria control on the continent, can be a little bit risk averse. By that, I mean they want to put money and support a product that's already made. So the big foundations like the Dangote Foundation have done a wonderful, wonderful job of, for example, supporting bed net distribution. But who's going to develop in Africa the next generation of bed net equivalent without some sort of infrastructural support? So that really is, for me, that is my big call. That's why I set up the Vital Narrative, was to try and figure out a way to nurture this upstream innovation on the continent. The idea there is that over the next few years, I hope to attract some of the small businesses in Africa who have these wonderful ideas and try and partner those with people who are willing to invest in them, with some impact investments or even philanthropy. Over back to you. I hope that wasn't too long and detailed.
Oh, no, not at all. You know, and I realize that we're trying to stick to time, but I mean, this is also a good opportunity for you to let us know more about some of what your expectations are in the near future as far as elimination of malaria is concerned. Where do you think the efforts should be channeled more towards across the five group of critical stakeholders? And when I say the five groups, I talk about the groups being also recognized by the United Nations on sustainable development goals. So to be the UN itself, the government of respective countries, civil society, academia, and of course the private sector. What do you consider as, and I hear you did say, not even comparing the efforts of these critical stakeholders, not comparing some of this mortality to COVID-19. COVID-19 received a rapid response. Again, maybe because the deaths were glaring in our faces. What do you expect these critical stakeholders to do more of? And people like us in ABC Health and what we represent, what do you expect for us to do more of in joining hands together and combating this mortality, disease burden of malaria on the African continent? Over to you, Peter. And this will be the last question, so feel free to amplify it and to make it as multidimensional as you think fit.
I think it's a wonderful question, because what you've done there, Maurice, is mention almost all of the stakeholders in some way or another. I would love to see a much more integrated pipeline of development. So what I mean by that is what I was saying earlier, is to be able to support all the way from innovation to implementation, the major stakeholders, the United Nations, the global funds of this world, are at the implementation end. That's what they do. A new vaccine is available. They will support that to be deployed in Africa. And that's really essential, because that means that while malaria control products are not considered particularly profitable by that level of large-scale support from United Nations and similar organizations, even the Dangotes of this world, that ensures that there is a market at the end. So that end of it, I think, is in reasonable shape. It could always do with more funding, of course. The front end of this, in meaning the innovation end, in some parts of the world, is in good shape. And by that, I mean, if you are in Africa, in America, if you're in Europe, Australia, probably India as well, there are mechanisms where you can apply for money, develop your ideas and product under a granting scheme, and then move forward into that middle sector, which is the product development period. So there are two gaps here, I feel. One is at the front end, and that is encouraging by having some sort of funding infrastructure, more innovation on the African continent, so that those wonderful scientists and people with ideas can develop their ideas for Africa within Africa. And I feel that's a gap. It always relies on partnerships, which is fine, but the partnerships are always pushed from the West rather than from Africa. Great example, in Kilifi in Kenya, the Wellcome Trust have the most magnificent research center there. But it is really funded by the Wellcome Trust from the UK. And that level of support to African research institutions from Africa, it still has to be realized. So when you go from innovation, then you need to go to product development. And there are terms here that sound horrible. It's called the Valley of Death, where products that are pretty good just still cannot get the infrastructure, the funding, the help to move from having proof of principle to getting more towards clinical testing or on the ground testing. Those are the gaps that I see. And so I would like to see that much more as a transparent pipeline for the global community. There are policy documents put out from WHO, from elsewhere, which are fine, but they tend to be very focused, for example, on vaccines, on new drugs or something. But I don't see a very transparent set of documents that people like CAMA can use to say, this is where we want to be involved. I'd like to see that at some point. Just to wrap up, I set up the Vital Narratives to try and address that very upstream part of what's going on. In our work with Scenaria, it's very clear that innovation work is possible in the US and Europe, but we rarely saw similar organizations or small companies doing that kind of work in a sustained way in Africa. And so what I'm hoping to do there is foster that innovation, and maybe the next stage as well, by first of all attracting the small businesses to talk to me, and then helping them approach some of the people who may be willing to fund them. And this idea is really at a very early stage, but I feel that it's a way of fostering the small business ecology, if you like, in the continent of Africa to help itself and to reduce the dependency on grants from the US and Europe. There's no question in my mind, Maurice, that there is willingness and money on the continent of Africa to do this. It's just a question of finding a way of pulling it all together. That's my objective over the next 2 or 3 years. Back to you.
Thank you so very much. for that very insightful and very deliberate charge around what you expect as an expert to see more of, more especially around the efforts that players and actors against malaria are making. I mean, this discussion, no doubt, for me, underscores the urgent need for a unified and sustained effort to combat malaria. And we hear you clearly. We're going to reflect on some of your thought leaderships that you've shared today. Malaria is indeed that disease that has continued to challenge economic growth, even though a lot of African countries refuse to actually measure the actual impact, the negative impact of the disease burden, and also well-being of millions of people across the continent. Even though significant strides have been made to prevent and eliminate, the road to malaria elimination requires more African-centric, more innovative solutions, and a lot of deliberate investment in our research and development, and of course, the efficient use of our resources. Despite the fact that there are resources on the continent, it just needs to be channeled appropriately. Peter, the insights you've shared today reminds us of the complexities of this fight and the critical role that innovation plays, innovation, research, and strategic partnerships in advancing our efforts. It becomes more apparent that no single approach is sufficient. And instead, an integrated strategy that combines traditional methods with groundbreaking technologies is essential to address the evolving challenges, such as drug and insecticide resistance and shifting vector behavior, and so on and so forth. As we move forward, we must reflect as critical stakeholders on the role that each one of us play in this journey, whether through research, through advocacy like CAMA and ABC Health, and leveraging some of the platforms that we actually have. Of course, funding cannot be overemphasized, and community engagement. Every contribution and effort matter. The fight against malaria is not just a fight for our health. It is a fight for the future of the continent, for the children and the communities, and also its prosperity. Peter, I must thank you so very much for doing this with us and for being part of this crucial conversation. And this is just the start. We would like to engage more with you, to do more, to tease out what next actions and next steps must be. And together, with determination and collaboration, we can achieve the vision of a malaria-free Africa and leave a legacy of health, hope, and resilience for generations to come. Thank you once again, Peter. I don't know if you have parting words for us today, but on my part, it's been a real pleasure doing this podcast with you. Over to you, Peter.
Thank you so much. It's also been a pleasure and an honor to work with you today and to discuss all these really important topics. I think what you just said there is a beautiful summary of the complexity of the day, of the problem. And I love the word that you used there, Maurice, deliberate. We have to be much more deliberate. And hopefully this will be the start of a message toward that. Thank you so much for having me on.
Brilliant. Thank you, Peter. And have a good day ahead. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.